Raggi, King Raggi, Aberarning, Stannar in 1-1, í Nýs, gjör svo vel.
Hello and welcome to the latest By the Minute Aberdeen podcast. This week, we've got Grant Fiskin back for his first appearance of the season. Grant, how are you?
Good, thanks, Richard.
And joining us all the way from the USA is Ian Thompson. Ian, hello.
Hi, how are you?
So Ian's a lifelong Dons fan. Pertinent to this week, Ian wrote a book called Summer of 67, all about the International Soccer Tournament, which was held in 1967, unsurprisingly, which featured the Washington Whips. Now, for those that don't know, the Washington Whips were us, were Aberdeen. And we'll talk a little bit more about that 50th anniversary later in the show. Before then, let's have a discussion about some of the squad changes that have happened since we were last on your podcasting network. So, first of all, Grant, a new deal for Shay Logan. Now, this maybe not as much of a surprise as last time he re-signed, but still a very welcome piece of business.
Absolutely, and yeah, as you say, it's amazing to think that we were pretty much resigned to losing him last year, and then now we've got him until 2020. And having a player that you almost take for granted that plays pretty much every game, consistent performer, just having somebody that reliable, you can't put a price on that. And he's the kind of player that gets the other. You can tell he gets the other players going. He can get the crowd going. Seems to be a popular figure. And yeah, that was a great bit of news.
Ian, it's clear that as well as some of the signings we've made, that some of the money that's come into the club over the past 12 months has gone towards enhanced deals for the likes of Logan, for the likes of Joe Lewis in goals. But these are key signings, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I think and one thing which I see over here with a lot of teams in the States is that it's just like players just swap teams. It's almost like pickup games, you know, like you play for this team this year and then you go here the next year. And you know, I think having those integral parts, particularly in the defence, having consistency with them so that they're playing with each other year after year, can only strengthen the team.
Now, one of the signings, the two that we made this week, Gary Mackay-Stephen was brought in from Celtic, where he'd really dropped off the radar, having been signed previously from Dundee United. Now, he was very much the coming thing whilst part of that Dundee United team. A winger, an out-and-out winger, unquestionably, but somebody that chipped in with his fair share of goals at Tannadice. We're not getting a straight replacement for either McGinn or Hayes here, Grant, I suspect. He's kind of somewhere in between.
It's potentially a great signing, but getting him on the pitch for a consistent run of games, he's very, very much a confidence player. And I mean, we've all seen the tricks he can come up with. It's just phenomenal at this level, but it's getting that consistency level of performance. And he had that stage at Dundee United, but then when he goes to a club like Celtic, it's almost as if they didn't quite trust him enough to do it consistently, and that's why he was kind of in and out of the team. And I'm sure we'll talk about it towards the Shiroki game, but losing McGinn and Hayes is obviously a massive blow in their position, but I think it has you can't underestimate how much of an impact it has on some of the other players who are still here, like Logan, Constein and Rooney. These guys had so good partnerships with the likes of McGinn and Hayes, particularly Considine, I think. And fitting in Mackay-Stephen and having somebody cover his defensive duties who's not going to provide like Hayes does is going to be a challenge for McInnes. But I just hope. I was actually surprised he was thrown in from the start, just after signing, because he is the kind of player that you need a few games to just get him fully going. But if we can just get him getting a run of games, get to the kind of form he's with Dundee United, I think it could be a very good signing.
Ian, he, as well as certainly Greg Stewart and maybe one or two other names who we put on this summer, are example of players who it's a bit of a gamble, isn't it? We're looking for them to recapture form, which they showed maybe a year, maybe two, maybe even longer in the case of Nicky Maynard.
Yeah, I think a lot of coaches would probably tell you that every signing is a gamble in some way. You know, I mean, you can have an excellent player. Is he going to fit in, you know, to the system at a club? Is he going to fit in his personal life to the city that he moves to? So there's always some element of doubt with it. But I think, you know, watching the team over the last few years, Hayes has obviously been a consistently excellent performer. I did get the impression that Niall McGinn was going a little bit stale. Compared to his performances in, you know, 2013, 2014. So looking at the potential upside here, you've got a guy who was a very good performer with Dundee United, earned that move to Celtic, hasn't quite panned out for him, he hasn't had the playing time, and so he's coming to Pittodrie now with a point to prove that he can still perform, and you know, he's 26 years old, so he's coming into his prime. And one other thing I like about him is he's from Thurso, so he's a Highlander, and I always kind of think that should be our patch. You know, we do a good job of signing all these guys from Inverness through the years, and you know, I kind of think that should really be our area, you know, going back to the days when we had Eric Black and Brian Gunn from that part of the world. So I think it's an exciting signing, and I think he has something to prove. He has to prove that he can get back to where he was.
Well, someone that we know a little bit more about, playing in a red shirt, returned to the club on Friday. Kari Arnason, the Icelandic defender, come centre midfielder. And actually, that's my question to you, Grant. Where do you think he's going to fit into this side? Is it obvious that he's going to play centre half?
I think at the moment, given our personnel, I think he has to play at centre half. Kari Arnason's a tricky one for me because there's been quite a lot of kind of hype about this deal in the past week, and everybody's really excited. Now, I think it's a good signing, but I always kind of think that he's got a bit of the Andy Dow factor about him. Then he was a very good player in a pretty poor team, and he is getting on a bit, and he did very well. He's a Champions League experience. He did very well for Iceland. I'd like to see him at centre half, but I hope it's not just the only defensive recruitment we're going to make. I still think we need another defender in there. Hopefully it brings a bit of calmness, because I think at the back, O'Connor and Reynolds together, it just doesn't seem for the safer. You're never quite sure. It's kind of still a bit of the Ash Taylor factor a bit. And if Arnason can just bring a bit of cool, bit of good passing, and obviously is the long throw factor as well, I can't see him playing in midfield at the moment. But if we did get another defensive player in, then at least it's a nice option to have if we need it.
Grant raises an interesting point there, Ian. Is it maybe an age thing? I mean, those of us who are a little bit older have obviously experienced far, far better centre-half stroke defensive midfielders playing for Aberdeen. But Kari Arnason was obviously a standout in what was a poor Dons team 5-6 years ago.
Yeah, but, you know, when you look at his performances in the Euros last year, he was absolutely exceptional. You know, that's playing at the highest level. So I think he's got the quality. I think at 34, what is he, 35 later this year? So I can't see him coming in and playing in the centre of midfield. I think he would slot into the defence. And he just brings a lot. I think he brings a lot of character. You know, I think he's someone that, because of what he did last year for Iceland, you know, he's maybe someone that just a lot of players in the dressing room can look up to and can learn from. You know, he brings a lot of character and experience back into the club. So, I heard you say there was a lot of hype about his signing in the last week. And over here, I didn't see any of it. So I think I was just at work this week, and my phone flashed up, and it was Aberdeen FC delighted Carrie's back. Saw the announcement, and so it took me completely by surprise. And I'm pleased about it. I think it's a good move, and I think, as you alluded to also, it shows that there's a little bit more funds coming into the club to really build a squad.
Well, Kari won't be available for the second leg against Sarokki, which we go into later this week, on the back of a 1-1 home draw, which was a little bit of a disappointment, a little bit anticlimactical. Certainly after a good positive start, it did seem for a spell that we were going to maybe overwhelm them and have a fairly straightforward evening. And that was on the back of Ryan Christie's goal after 15 minutes, and another piece of excellent work from Christie. He's going to be a very good, very important player for us this season, isn't he, Grant?
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's great that he's just picked up from where he left off. Confidence is obviously flooding through him now. He's obviously had a run of games at the end of last season, and this season he is going to be a massive player. And if he keeps keeps chipping in with this amount of goals, and that certainly takes a bit of the pressure off Rooney up top. Yeah, that chance from Mackay Stephen at 1-0 when he rounded the keeper, they were really on the rack at that point. Their defence was so jittery, and if that had gone in, I think it would have been a very comfortable evening. But I think after that, we've had such a settled team for the past 3-4 seasons that he really, really showed, particularly in the second half, that there was just a lot of players getting to know each other, and it takes time. And unfortunately, given just thrown into these qualifying rounds of the Europa League, you just don't have that time at this stage of the season. We just have to hope that a week in training, a week more work, and they can improve on that they showed in the second half on Thursday.
Yeah, Ian, it was a very disjointed performance from start to finish. It was a bit of a surprise that the goal didn't settle the team down, but as Grant says, a lot of changes over the summer. A lot of key personnel leaving, including in midfield. Now, a lot of people won't necessarily see Ryan Jack as a key player, particularly because of where he's gone to. There's not a like-for-like replacement in Greg Tansey, is there? It's going to be a different style in that midfield.
It is just the same every year, isn't it, with these games that when it just appears, I don't know, maybe I'm a little bit older too, that I like the summer off. You know, you kind of, as a fan, you need to emotionally recharge and have that downtime and think about doing other things with your life, because, you know, the season seems to, you know, grind on for so long these days. And coming back, what was it, July 13th, they played the game. I always feel it's, you know, there's a potential there for some completely random results. As you say, I think hopefully with another week of training and another week of guys beginning to know each other and see how they play, we can get through it. And I think there's definitely enough quality in the team that we can go there and win. I mean, I saw on your Facebook posts you've been going on about, it's 3 years to the day since we went away to Croatia and won at Rijeka. So hopefully we can go there and get a result. I think we're more than capable of doing it. But it is tough, you know, coming back at this time of year and trying to grind through these early qualifying rounds.
Yeah, it's 2 years since Rijeka. We won't hold that against you. We know it's very early in the morning over in the States, Ian, so that's okay. The approach that they adopted, Grant, we'd maybe in all the sort of pre-match previews that I'd read, and certainly from watching them in their away game in Kazakhstan, very much expected them to go with one up front, but it was more like a two, and they broke very, very well. The transition from defending to attacking was really swift. Very often they would be man for man against our defence, not necessarily one for one or two for two, but you know, four, they would get bodies up in attack, as evidenced by their goal, which obviously their left back put away. It was quite a shock just how open they were and how much they'd come to play football.
It was, and how many clear chances they created as well. They noticed pretty early on that there was a bit of unsureness in our midfield and defence, as you mentioned about the ball retention, with Tansey's a slightly different player from Jack. And again, Shinny McLean and Jack have been so used to playing with each other, and Tansey's just not quite that type of player. And the fullbacks as well, as I mentioned earlier about the Considine just looked a little unsure without the protection in front of him. And I think they just they saw quite early that they could capitalise on that on the break. We just didn't seem to have the same organisation that we're so much used to. And I think we were lucky we only conceded one goal, because they had a couple of really clear chances. And it's going to be interesting if they set up like that again, which I'm pretty sure there's no reason why they shouldn't. And it's something we will have to address for next week.
There were issues all over. And again, rustiness, new players being brought in, they're all legitimate excuses, but it is a bit of a worry, because again, it's only the third competitive game, and going in cold to the second round is something we're not used to, Ian. It's clear that when we've been able to get those results against the likes of Groningen 3 years ago and Rijeka 2 years ago, they were in the same boat as us. They went in cold against our team, which had played competitive matches, and it really does make a big difference.
You know, I hear these increasing calls for summer football in Scotland, because, you know, that would possibly help us in Europe. But, you know, I don't think it's quite that simple. If you move to summer football, it makes it complicated for you in the transfer market, because, you know, players in other countries are transferring and their seasons are finishing at different times. And I'm not sure that I want to see the Scottish Cup final played in November. You know, there's there's a kind of a nice aspect to you grind through the winter and then the weather starts improving and the sun comes out and you have your day at hand and at the end of the season. So I really don't know how we fix this. You know, obviously a lot of talk with Rangers going out and St Johnstone going out too, and you know, people that get all worked up about our coefficient, and if that reduces, it makes it harder for us down the line. And I don't really know what the solution is. I mean, there are enough other teams and enough other countries that are out there that are in the same boat as us. So surely the problems lie much deeper than whether we play a winter schedule or a summer schedule.
I think it comes down to a little bit of our own fault as well. It's our home form in Europe again. We keep leaving ourselves an awful lot to do in away games, and we're not going to keep on pulling out results every time. And that's the thing that concerns me for next Thursday. Every season we've had these draws at home, and it's strange that why we've not been able to convert the domestic home form into the European home form.
Yeah, that's just 3 wins in 10 home Europa League games over the past 4 seasons. And, you know, those wins were... one of them was against Daugavpilsen. So I think, you know, I could have assembled 11 people to have beaten them, quite frankly. But yes, it is a concern. The away form has patched over that. And obviously, for example, the Rijeka game, it didn't matter so much that we drew at home, having gone there and won. And 0-0 against Groningen turned out to be a pretty good result. But yeah, conceding that away goal in particular leaves us open. It means we do have to be clinical away from home. Which again, obviously last year in Maribor we weren't, but we head to Herzegovina on Thursday, and I'm wondering, Grant, that maybe that formation-wise we might see a tweak. Away from home in Europe, Dermot McInnes has very often gone for 3 at the back. Do you think that would make sense on Thursday?
If Arnesen had been available, then I think it would have definitely been, but given the personnel, I'm not really sure he's going to do that. I don't think he'd be willing to put Shinny back to wing back and Constein into the centre. So, yeah, I just think given the options in the squad at the moment, I can't see him doing it, although he has liked doing it in the past. Maybe if we did get through to the next round, it's something you might think about, but that would be a big call to move Shinny and move Constein inside if he was going to do it, because I don't really see much other options for him to do that.
But one thing's for sure, Ian, is that we do need a goal. We need to score over there. Whether it's to get a 1-1, take a extra time and penalty kicks, or to win the game, we need to score. Adam Rooney is attracting, seems to be early favourite for 2017-2018 Boo Boy, it would seem. Do you start with him on Thursday night? Occasionally, Dermot McInnes has shown a tendency not to start Rooney away from home in Europe. Or alternatively, there's the option to pair him up with somebody else. Jaden Stockley's available again on Thursday, for example.
I guess I need to defer to you guys a little bit because you're there, you see a lot more of the games than I do. When I watch Rooney, he scores goals. So I find it hard to think that you wouldn't start with him. And from what I've seen of Stockley in the games that I do watch, I haven't really seen him do too much. So... you know, and again, you guys probably have, you know, you're closer to it than I am, but I'd be surprised if that was the move that he went for. I mean, Rooney just, what is that, you know, 3-4 seasons, he's just consistently put the ball in the back of the net. So you can't really argue with that. And, you know, he's strong in the air, he's a good finisher on the ground. You know, as you've mentioned, we need to score. So I'd be surprised if we didn't start with him.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I'm amazed at the amount of stick that he started to get, Rooney, in the past few months. I think it's just utterly ridiculous. I mean, I've had a player who scores that much of goals. I mean, he's not expected to do everything himself. As long as he's there to put the ball in the net. And as I mentioned earlier about the partnership, it's going to take a bit of time for the other guys to get to know his runs in that, which McGinn and Hayes could find him in their sleep. And yeah. I'd be amazed if Rooney didn't start. I'd be extremely disappointed if Stockley started, put it that way.
Well, it's going to be hot over there. It's going to be not that intimidating atmosphere. The ground only holds 5,500, and there will be, as ever, a reasonable contingent of the Red Army over there. In all these things, the experience of the recent Euro ties, the last 3 or 4 years, we mentioned Rijeka earlier on. I mean, that was 30 plus degrees. Grant, you can tell us exactly what that was like because you were there, obviously. all this should really help. We might have lost a few bodies over the summer, but there's still a lot of that squad who've got experience of playing these games.
Yeah, I mean, that night in Rijeka, it was bloody hard being a fan. It was so hot, but these guys, they're fit enough. They've got the sports scientists or whatever. They should be fine with the heat. But yeah, the experience of playing in those conditions and knowing the knowledge that they can produce an away result, an away performance. As you said, they did play pretty well against Maribor, apart from not being clinical. And you'd like to hope that that experience will stand them in good stead, and they shouldn't panic, and that we are capable of scoring away from home. I just hope that that comes to fruition, because it would be pretty devastating to go out at this stage of the competition.
And I think it would be doubly so, given that the qualifying round 3 draw, which was made on Friday, paired us with, again, it's a tough tie. They're on paper, they've got a better coefficient than us, they were the seeded side, but it's likely to be Apollon Limassol in qualifying round 3. Now, Ian, from the possibilities that we could have had, which were, you know, AC Milan, Everton, who've been spending hundreds of millions of pounds this summer, it's a reasonable tie and a reasonable opportunity, not that we want to look beyond Thursday, but a reasonable chance to make it to that final qualifying round.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, you can get the glamour of Everton or AC Milan, but I would really not want to be playing them in July and having the European campaign over with before the domestic season starts. So, I think it does provide a huge incentive that if we do get through, then the next round is also one that you would look at as being a winnable tie and you know, pushing us that little bit closer towards the group stage.
And it's not only that, Grant, is it? They've stated publicly, repeatedly, that the group stages is the aim, and to fall so far short would be a huge disappointment.
It would, and I was quite surprised that they actively said that we're looking for the group stages, because I think it's almost nigh on impossible, given even if we get through the second and third rounds, it'll be another big team in the playoff round likely. I think the draw, as you say, yeah, it could have been Everton, but I think it's a pretty similar draw to the last couple of years. I think Apollon Limassol will be pretty similar to the Kyrat and Maribor. I mean, they've got a pretty decent European pedigree. They've been in the group stages themselves a couple of times in the last few years. It's not just if we get knocked out. I mean, it'd be just pathetic for Scottish football. You can't, and you were talking about the summer football thing earlier, but some of these teams we're playing haven't started their seasons either. And after spending three seasons in the third qualifying round, to go out a round earlier just almost seems unthinkable. But now we have that draw, maybe that's another incentive. Not that they should need one, but not to make that progress would be really disappointing.
And it really would, wouldn't it, Ian? It would be a black mark against this team. And you can see it impacting, not just because we'd miss out in competitive games ahead of the start of the league season, but you can really see it impacting on the start of the domestic form as well, can't you?
Yeah, you can. I think it's also difficult to judge. You know, I was saying earlier just about when we were talking about Shea Logan signing a new deal and Joe Lewis staying with the club, you have that consistency of the squad and you know, what is it that maybe gives the other team the edge or doesn't give us an edge? And I don't know too much about the Bosnian team here. If they have the same squad that are coming back, if they have that familiarity, or are some of these other teams in the same boat as us, where they've just had huge turnover through the summer? It appears to be just, you know, I don't want to say toss of a coin, because it's a little bit more than that, but there's potential for a huge random element in these ties. But I think following on from what has happened with the other Scottish teams this year, it's pretty grim. It's pretty grim. And I think that, you know, quite often you hear people say, like, we need to be realistic in Scotland. We're only a country of 5 million people. Should we really be expecting to go far in Europe? And I think that's a little bit defeatist. I mean, we still are a pretty proud footballing country. That's the national sport. We're obsessed with it. We should be doing better. You know, there's other countries out there like Croatia that just continually produce great players and punch way above their weight, as do Portugal, as do some of these other small countries. Now, of course, we're not at that level, but we could be doing a lot better than we are. So I think one thing which I do take some comfort with is that I think we have the right mentality for these ties, you know, whether we get through it or not. I think for so long I felt that Scottish clubs, when we went into Europe, we just didn't have the right approach. We couldn't handle the home and away legs and the importance of the away goals. We just seemed to be behind the curve. Now, you know, 1-1 at home, it's not necessarily over. And I think we do have that mentality and that experience at Aberdeen where, you know, we know we can go there and we can win. And I think one other factor that I kind of see too is that in years gone by, going to Europe really was pretty daunting. And I think that going to Bosnia, it's not necessarily as daunting as it would have been way back when airfare was different and you didn't have the internet and whatever else. The world's a smaller place. I think a lot of these games, it's a more homogenous kind of atmosphere. So, you know, I do take some comfort that we've got the experience and we can go there, know what we have to do, and hopefully can pull it out.
One thing that really struck me on Thursday, Grant, was that Soroki Brzeziak really, truly believed they were going to score. They believed they were going to get a result. We're going to need similar on Thursday, aren't we?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that chance just before half-time, that header, I think that gave them a lot of belief to have a proper go in the second half. And at least I think Ian mentions we got the right mentality. I think that's definitely right. Even if we lose the first goal, I mean, I don't think we'll panic. It doesn't really change things too much. It will be interesting to see how Soroki approach this, and if they're going to be happy to hold on for a 0-0 and maybe sit back, and that could make it difficult, or whether they're going to go for a goal themselves. So yeah, there's going to be a few questions for McInnes to answer, but I'm still 50-50. I think when you mentioned the extra time and penalties earlier, I could quite see that being a possibility.
I'm not sure my nerves could take that, to be perfectly honest, but we will see what transpires on Thursday night. We'll have a minute by minute of the game for you on www.bytheminute.co. So, moving on to our guest Ian Thompson, and the 50th anniversary, which was on Friday, of the Washington Whips final against the LA Wolves, which was Aberdeen versus Wolves, but transported to the United States. So Ian, tell me how this game and this whole tournament came about.
Yeah, so back to happier times when I think really this was Scottish football at its best. And of course we've had all of the tributes and all of the parading about the 50th anniversary of the Lisbon Lions recently. So you know, if you just sort of the wider context of Scottish football at that time, in April of 1967 we'd famously beaten England 3-2 at Wembley. And then that season, Celtic had obviously won the European Cup. Rangers had got to the European Cup Winners' Cup final and lost in extra time to Bayern Munich. Kilmarnock got to the Fairs Cup semi-final and were beaten by Don Revie's Leeds United. And just beyond that, you had Dundee United at that point had knocked Barcelona out of the Fairs Cup, beating them home and away. Barcelona were the holders. Dundee United also beat Celtic twice that season, were the only team domestically to beat Celtic. And we had a pretty good team too, as did Hibs, you know, so there was a lot of depth in Scottish football. And what had happened is in 1966, when England had beaten West Germany in the World Cup final, this was the first time that a game had been televised in its entirety on American network television. So back then in the States, you only had, I think it was three channels they had back then, as opposed to the 30,000 now. And the audience that tuned in to watch that game in the States were kind of blown away, because you had, you know, whether you like it or not, you had a pretty dramatic game with West Germany equalising in the last minute of normal time, and then obviously Jeff Hurst, was it in, was it not, incident. And then at the end, Bobby Moore going up and being presented with the trophy by the Queen. So the American audience was just utterly captivated by this. And what it really did was it fueled a bunch of sports entrepreneurs over in the States to set up the first serious attempt at a East Coast to West Coast nationwide professional soccer league. And, you know, excuse if I say soccer instead of football, I've been here too long. By no means was this the first attempt at bringing soccer to the States. There had been various leagues, and throughout the 60s there had been a lot of teams that travelled over, mainly to the New York area to compete in summer tournaments. Kilmarnock had come over in 1961 and reached the final of a tournament, which was a similar idea that these foreign teams would come and play for a month or two in New York. But all these games, it was kind of like an exhibition tournament held in the New York area. And so 67 was the first time that... Now, bizarrely enough, two competing leagues went up against each other to try and see which one would become the dominant league, because here, even to this day in the United States, leagues compete against each other rather than having a proper federation that structures one pyramid where everyone is part of the one scheme. So it gets complicated, but the league that Aberdeen were involved in, the United Soccer Association, it was called, it included 12 franchises going from Vancouver, San Francisco, Los Angeles on the West Coast to Washington, Boston, New York, etc. on the East Coast. And this league was a little bit slower in getting off the ground than its competitor. And its competitor league had a television contract. They had a little bit more time. They were scouting for players. And one former Aberdeen player, Ernie Winchester, actually got recruited to play for one of the teams in that league. And so this second league, the United Soccer Association, with a little bit less time to get up and running, and knowing that their rival already had a TV contract and had some players signed, they decided, look, we need to go quick. Can we just go out and recruit entire teams from abroad, fly them in for the summer of 67 to play in this league? And then come 1968, we've had the time to sign our own players and build our own teams. And so one of those franchises was the Washington Whips. Funnily enough, now I live in DC, and RFK Stadium, the old Redskins Stadium, was where Aberdeen played. I can see it from my balcony of my house. It's about a 10-minute drive away, so it's funny how things turn out. But yeah, the Dons came here, and because at that point you had... England were the World Cup champions. Scotland were at that point one of the strong nations, and because of the cultural similarities and the language similarities between the US and the United Kingdom, it was an obvious home where a lot of the games administrators in the States went to get the advice on who could come and play. And so Aberdeen, Dundee United and Hibernian were the three Scottish teams that came over. Wolves, Sunderland and Stoke City from England, two Northern Irish teams, and then one or two others from Italy, the Netherlands, and from South America.
And so it was 12 teams. Was it split into two divisions? Because we were in the East section. Is that right, Ian? Or was that just the name of the league?
Yeah, that's right. It was split into a West and an East, and so the format of the competition actually was that everyone played each other anyway, but. So with 12 teams, you would play 11 games if you played everyone once. And then they paired it into the East and the West, and then you played another game against someone from your location to bring it up to 12 games. And then what happened was the two conference winners then went on to meet for the overall championship. And so as it panned out, we had a pretty strong conference. There was a lot of competition. And when I spoke to, I spoke to players from eight of the teams, all of the British and Irish teams, I tracked down former players and interviewed them, and there were a range of attitudes towards it. You know, you had some of the players that, this was a summer holiday, this was a jaunt, they weren't really taking it that seriously. But then you had some teams, and Aberdeen being one of them, with Eddie Turnbull, who was a very strict disciplinarian coach, that you couldn't let him down. You know, you couldn't go out and you couldn't let him catch you drinking. So he was very much wanting to win this tournament, and so Aberdeen took it very seriously, as did Wolverhampton Wanderers, as did some of the other players. So yeah, we had a pretty competitive group with Stoke, who were playing in Cleveland, were up there looking for to get to the final two. And just as another motivation to the players, these were millionaire American business owners that were bankrolling these teams. For example, in Detroit, you had Glenn Torren that came over to Detroit. Now, the Detroit franchise was owned by the Ford Motor family. So there was a lot of big bucks going into the game, sort of tentatively seeing if this new game of soccer could really take off and captivate the American market. So the players were on quite heavy win bonuses, some of them. And so what a few of them said to me too was that in those days, and Dundee United were a prime example, that they didn't really pay big wages or big win bonuses. And when your season finished, and in those days the season finished in April, you didn't get paid for the summer. And so these guys were kind of delighted that they could go to the States. They were earning a higher weekly wage than they were back home. And if they won, they were getting quite hefty win bonuses too. So it turned into quite a competitive event.
Yeah, because it wasn't what we might think of as a tour these days. Because, we played games from May 26th right through to the middle of July, the final against Wolves being on the 14th. So obviously, 12 league games. Well, in fact, it turned out to be 13 league games, and we'll come to why in a minute. But being based in Washington, obviously the administrative centre of the States, it led to a very famous season ticket holder, didn't it, Ian?
It did, yes. So Lyndon B. Johnson, who was the American president at that time, was presented with a season ticket for the Washington Whips on the night, the day before the tournament's first game, which was 26th of May that year. So we played Stoke in the first game at RFK Stadium and actually managed to lose that game 2-1. But the franchise owner had managed to get a little invite to the White House on the day before the game, and Eddie Turnbull went along with him to meet President Johnson and present him with a season ticket. So it's just one of these fantastic quirks where I like to say that Aberdeen were the only team that had a US president as a season ticket holder. And there is a fabulous photograph of the meeting. And Eddie Turnbull was presented at the end of the tournament by the franchise owner in Washington with a photograph of him shaking hands with Lyndon Johnson, and the line underneath it was the most powerful man in the world meets the president of the United States.
Well, we touched a little bit on some of the culture shocks for the players, but for the watching spectators as well, there must have been a degree of that too, because I'm looking at our results and there were a hell of a lot of draws in our league matches, and that's not something that traditionally goes down well in American sports, is it?
Yeah, I just pulled up the spreadsheet of our results here, and we had one spell where we drew five games in a row in the middle of the tournament, and as I say, it did get pretty competitive in our division, and we managed to just eke out first place in the end. It's funny, thinking about how this tournament went over, because you had this big potential audience that had watched the World Cup final, the businessmen were trying to get hooked on this new foreign game. And it's funny that even 50 years on, I think that the businessmen that try to run sports in this country haven't quite sussed out how to sell the game to people. And to me, the secret is you don't really need to sell it to them. Americans have a different way of doing things. The crowds were not too bad. I think here in DC we got around about 8,000 crowds on average. Los Angeles too was about 9,000. You had some cities like Boston had Shamrock Rovers who went over there. I think with the usual kind of cliched thinking of let's get the Irish team to Boston, and there wasn't really too much more went into the trying to market the franchise beyond that, and the crowds just really dwindled to 3,000 or 4,000, and some even hitting three figures. Now, funnily enough, in the last in May, Glentoran came back over to Detroit to mark the 50th anniversary, and I went up to that game. Detroit City have an amateur team, believe it or not, that pulls 7,000, 8,000 people to their games, because they get it. It's a grassroots. It's not a franchise. It's not owned by a billionaire. It's not all shiny marketing. It's grassroots. It's community. It's everything that we think the game should be and love about the game. And when I was up there, there was a guy who would have been probably in his late 50s, and he went to the games back in 1967. He went to all of the Detroit Cougars games, and he had a scrapbook with him of all the match programs. And you know, this is just fabulous for me. I love all that stuff. I could spend all day just, you know, reading through everything that he had. And so he had very fond memories of it. And I was just delighted to meet him, because I did think, you know, was anyone that was around at these games, can I track them down? I mean, do people still exist that went along at that time? And you know, a few people had asked me when I was doing the book, you know, how did you manage to track down fans? And I really just didn't know where to start. So, you know, there were some people that have fond memories of it, and for them, that was their first introduction to the game, and it really struck a chord with them, and they've become lifelong fans. But I think generally, if you were to look at it, it really wasn't too successful. And as I mentioned earlier, you had a competing league that had 10 teams. So in total in 67, you had 22 teams. And the following year, the two leagues merged to form what became the North American Soccer League, famously with Pelé and Beckenbauer and all the stars in the 70s. And so from those original 22 teams, when you rolled forward a few years, only the team in Dallas, the Dallas Tornado, was still active. Everyone else had dropped off the radar. So, you know, kind of a turbulent beginning to professional soccer, I would say.
Now, you said that we squeezed through the group stage, yeah, which indeed we did. Now, we only managed that because of a hastily rearranged game against our eventual final opponents, Wolves, the LA Wolves, as they were. Can you tell us how that came about?
Yeah, and I think, you know, this being a new sport to the States, and a lot of administrators who came from baseball and basketball and American football backgrounds that didn't really get the laws of the game, and referees that, you know, you had in the States, you know, you have a really incredible history of the game in this country going back to the 1880s. Of expat workers that came over here, and because the country is so vast, you know, people have always struggled to have a professional league. So you've had a lot of ethnic-based local leagues in New York, Philadelphia, some of the big industrial cities. So, you know, you were pulling referees that had refereed in good amateur leagues, and now they were in a professional environment. You know, so just a lot of funny quirks, and Wolves fell victim to one of those during our scheduled meeting with them during the regular season. So they had come to RFK Stadium in DC to play us, you know, just the regular game, and we drew 1-1, and unbeknown to Wolves, you could use three substitutes, but you could only use two substitutes that were outfield players. You could substitute a goalkeeper if your goalkeeper had an injury, and there was some lack of clarity over the rule, and Wolves had a few injuries during the game, and they used three outfield substitutes. Now, back home, you didn't have substitutes still in those days. I think it was just the year after that substitutes came in, so this was like a new concept, and so the Wolves management team probably weren't really too used to using substitutes. They were apparently told by the officials, yeah, that's fine, you can put the substitute on. It really didn't have any outcome on the game, which was a 1-1 draw, but someone from the Whips had just speculatively lodged a complaint that Wolves had used an illegal player, an illegal substitute. And it kind of threw the tournament into some chaos, because they didn't make a judgment at that time. What they said was, obviously, very difficult to get the team from Los Angeles to come back to Washington, the other end of the continent, to play a revised game. So they said, well, we'll make them do it if the ultimate outcome of the tournament depends on this result. And as it turned out, the outcome depended on this result, because Aberdeen were, you know, sort of competing still with Stoke, and needed, could have got to the final if they could beat Wolves in this revised game. And so ultimately, we were forced to play Wolves again. We played them on a Monday night here in Washington. We beat them 3-0, and then both teams then flew to LA to then meet in the final at the end of that week. So, you know, just another sort of quirky, funny incident about this whole tournament, really.
And that could have been avoided, therefore, if we'd beaten Shamrock Rovers 2 days earlier. So,
yeah, that's correct. And that Shamrock game too, I think, you know, we absolutely hammered them, absolutely battered them, and somehow they scored a couple of goals and beat us 2-1. But, you know, I think it's funny too when you look at it, you know, Glentoran, Shamrock Rovers struggled a little bit. So that result, us losing to them, was a real shock, because they just had thrown the towel in, it seemed like. I guess, you know, they just thought, right, one for the road, let's just go for it, lads. But Glentoran, on the other hand, you know, they really did well. You know, they really mixed it in with some of the big guys and got some good results. But I think, you know, it's easy in this day and age to forget, because there's such a massive gulf now between the haves and have-nots. But back in 67, you know, you had good players that just had good day jobs, and Glentoran had a lot of guys that would work in the shipyards or had heavy industry jobs that were good players. And, you know, they could hold teams for 60, 70 minutes. Now, the fitness might tell in the last 20 minutes, but they were there and thereabouts. And, you know, I think for Glentoran, one of the reasons they came back to Detroit this year was because this is a momentous, 67 is a momentous piece of their history as a club, because not only did they come and play against all these professional sides and do very well, but when they went back home, they drew Benfica in the first round of the European Cup, and they drew 1-1 in Belfast. They went away to Lisbon, they drew 0-0, and they were one of the first teams to go out of the European Cup on away goals. And this to, you know, a Benfica team with Eusebio that went on to the final and lost to Manchester United. So, you know, I think it's, you know, people think, oh, it's just a part-time team. But way back then, there wasn't quite the gulf in quality that you obviously have now.
Now, the final itself has something of a classic, really. A shambolic classic, maybe, but a classic nonetheless. Over 17,000 in the Coliseum in LA. And, well, everything went on in that game. Can you talk us through it, if you can?
Yeah, I remember... Yeah, backing up a little, and you know how I kind of got into writing this book was that I've moved frequently in the past 5 years with my wife's job until we got here in DC, and in 2012 we'd moved to a place called Morgantown in West Virginia, which is kind of, you know, very rural. I'd been working at the Wall Street Journal in New York as a journalist, and so I had to leave there. And sort of found myself with some downtime and not sure what I was going to do. So I started writing, you know, doing some freelance soccer writing over here in the States. And I thought, I need something to get my teeth into, you know, like get into a book project. And so in West Virginia, I'd been going to some college games over here. And that had got me in touch with Bobby Clark, yeah. Which is really how things started to come together. And Bobby, when I first spoke to him, you know, he'd talk about the first time that he came to the States in 67. And when I was a kid, I'd heard about this tournament, and I'd heard about Aberdeen representing the Washington Whips without really knowing the details. And so we just got into talking about it. And, you know, I was just fascinated by this tour. And then he was telling me about the final, just as, you know, how he described it was, he said it probably wasn't the best game that he played in, but it was certainly the craziest. You know? So we go into this game, and because this was now the third time that we played Wolves, there was a lot of kind of lingering resentment between a lot of the players. And so we had Ali Shewan in defence, who was kind of the famous Iron Man, you know, just strong man of our back line, who just never missed a game and was just so tough, so fierce. And Wolves had a centre forward, Northern Irish centre forward at the time, called Derek Dugan, who was, you know, the archetypal old school strong strapping centre forward, elbows, knees, fists, whatever it takes. And so this was the third time in the space of, you know, 4 or 5 weeks that these guys were playing against each other. And right from the off, it was a battle. I mentioned the refereeing earlier too. So you had kind of, you know, we got the bad side of it. We're after half an hour, Jimmy Smith was sent off for his involvement in a bit of a ruck with Dave Wagstaff, who was another fiery player that played for Wolves at the time. So it was 1-1 early in the game. You know, we were kind of, game's going well, pretty even, and then we go down to 10 men. We keep battling on. It doesn't really make much of a difference to the game. We go 3-2 ahead. Wolves come back 3-3, they go 4-3 ahead in 82 minutes, and you're thinking now, right, 10 men, the legs have gone. Last kick of the ball, Franny Munro scores to level the game, gets us 4-4, so we go into extra time. Wolves again go ahead 5-4, and you're thinking, okay, we're done, but we just have this phenomenal spirit where we just keep coming back. So we're still in the game at 5-4, and then it just gets really crazy. We're in the last minute of extra time, and Wolves get a penalty kick. And the gentleman who I spoke to, one of the guys I interviewed for the book, called Terry Wharton, who played for Wolves, he took 44 penalty kicks in his career. He scored 43 of them. So the only one he missed was in this game in the last minute, where Bobby Clark saved his penalty. And more or less, Bobby gets the ball from the penalty, throws it out, we go up the field, and Franny Munro scores. So we get to 5-5. Franny had just completed his hat-trick against Wolves that, you know, put him on the radar with Wolves, and they subsequently signed him a few months later. But we go at that point to then sudden death overtime. And so the game is still going on at this phenomenal, furious pace until finally, 6 minutes into the sudden death period, poor Ali Shewin manages to shin across past Bobby Clark and into his own net, and we lose 6-5. But there is YouTube footage of this game. It's about 26 minutes long. It's just an incredible watch. You know, when you look at the game, I don't know, you know, I was born in the 75. I started coming to games in the 80s, so I hadn't really too much of an awareness of what the game was like back then. But what struck me was, you know, a couple of things. One, the pace is absolutely incredible. You know, it's just guys sprinting all over the place, shutting people down. And then secondly, the aggression is pretty phenomenal to watch.
Well, if one thing we came back by the sound of it with was bruises. Did we take anything else back from that trip to the States to Aberdeen? I mean, only 10 years later, for example, Chris Anderson and Alex Ferguson, one of the first things that Fergie did when he was appointed was to head to the States to see examples of, you know, how they treated home crowds and stadiums there. Was there anything we took back?
Yeah, I'm not sure on that side. I mean, probably, because obviously you have that American mentality of really putting on a show. So that may well have played into Chris Anderson's thinking and moving to an all-seater stadia, which is something that was just, you know, a given over here. The facilities were way much better. I think on the playing side, we certainly took a lot back from that, because you had now... and similar to what we were talking about earlier with our current European situation, you had a bunch of players who were... We took a very young squad. We had a lot of players under the age of 21, and many of them had never been on a plane in their life, or if they had, they'd... And Martin Buchan was one example. He'd been on one plane ride in his life, and that was a few months before when he represented Scotland's youth team, and they flew from Glasgow to Gatwick. That was the extent of flying for him. You know, it's just guys didn't go on holiday. They didn't go anywhere, and so for 2 months they were being flown around on these, you know, transatlantic flights. So they grew up pretty quickly. They got a lot of experience, and I think that stood us in good stead in a few years' time when we had our own European campaigns. And it also just gave some amazing experience to some of these young players. You know, Bobby Clark, Martin Buchan as well, was just, you know, he was on the verge of breaking into the Aberdeen team at the time, and then he was taking on this tour, and that was really him being, you know, given the chance to play as a first teamer to see how he reacted, and he did very well, and, you know, the rest is history from there. So just the playing experience was really something that really in the years that came, we had a really good team. And it's unfortunate looking back where, and again, you know, I'm you know, this was a little bit before my generation, so I didn't know too much about Eddie Turnbull, but when you look at what he did for the club. And when we came back, we had a little bit of a lull, I think, the season after, because this two-month trip in the summer took its toll a little bit. But when you get into the late 60s, we beat Celtic in the Scottish Cup final. And then 71-72, in that era, you know, we could really have ended Celtic's nine in a row if it wasn't for a fire at Pittodrie that kind of affected the playing surface. You know, it felt to me, talking to people and learning about Eddie, the way that he played, his tactics and how good a manager he was, that there's a real missed opportunity that we really could have won a league title there.
Now, you spoke about Glenn Torin going over to mark the 50th anniversary this summer. Aberdeen, certainly last year, there was a celebration dinner for the remaining members of the Whips. And I think this year, obviously, it coincides with the first European Games, which there'll be a focus on as well. But have any of the other teams, have you noticed any of them marking the anniversary at all?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, obviously, the foreign teams, the South American teams were Cerro in Uruguay and Bangu in Brazil, that I think now are two teams that had prominence in the 60s and have now really fallen off the radar. In Italy, Cagliari, I'm not aware that they've really been doing much. I saw that Den Haag in the Netherlands, they had something commemorating it recently. I don't know if it was just a news item or something around the club. But I think it's, you know, there still has some resonance there. And they had an interesting team because they were coached by Ernst Happel, who later became the first man to win the European Cup twice with two different teams, sorry. He coached Feyenoord in the early 70s and then Hamburg in 1983. Mm-hmm. So, interestingly, they featured a young teenage player called Dick Advocaat. We had our first run-in with Dick Advocaat at Kezar Stadium in San Francisco. What I also found interesting too was that Walter Smith played for Dundee United, so they played against each other way back, you know, kind of one of those who knew moments. But the English teams, I think, although I'd like to think that there's some resonance, I think that this tournament still has some resonance for certain individuals, but Stoke City, for example, you know, and now they're an established Premier League team, it's not really on their radar. I had hoped that maybe Dundee United and Hibs would show a bit more respect for the tournament, but they probably didn't fare as well as we did. I haven't been aware of them really celebrating it in any way, apart from club historians writing about it.
So I'm
very happy that we did, and I think for Aberdeen it's obviously a proud moment that we performed well in the tournament and reached the final. And for Glentoran, I think, you know, obviously for them it's a huge part of their you know, who they are as a club. So I think us and them have been the two that have celebrated it most.
Well, certainly it's a unique... I mean, the club went on some extensive summer tours in the past. The Trailblazers, in a lot of respects, way back in our history, back around 1913, I think they went to Bohemia and places like that. And 1974, they did a pretty remarkable tour, including taking in Iran, New Zealand, Fiji and Australia. But yeah, this one in 1967, unlike any other, I would say. So a remarkable piece of Don's history, captured brilliantly in Ian's book, Summer of 67, which is available via Amazon and I think still at the club shop, Ian, is that right?
I'm not sure. Occasionally when I'm back, I'll drop off a few copies. I don't think they have any at the moment.
Right.
But,
okay.
Amazon is always just the best place to order it.
Excellent stuff. And thank you very much for joining us today, Ian.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me on. Pleasure.
Good stuff. And thank you to Grant. Grant, thanks very much.
Cheers, Richard.
So, we'll be back with you next week, hopefully looking ahead to a third-round qualifying tie against Apollo Limassol and not looking at the wounds of a self-inflicted defeat by Sir Oki Brijeg. So, until then, goodbye and thanks for listening.